Welcome, everyone. You're listening to Faded Mates.
Welcome back. This time around, we'll be talking about book number... Well, Sarah, we're already in trouble here with the book number two, book number three.
Well, I really think it's book number two, and we'll get there. First of all, I'm Sarah McLean, and I write romance novels, and I read romance novels.
I'm Jen Prokop. I read romance novels and talk about them a lot on Twitter.
Which is how we know each other.
Yeah.
But now we sort of know each other because we're faded mates.
That's right. Exactly.
So yeah, this is episode... I'm going to go with episode two, book number two. And this is why. So this is No Rest for the Wicked. And Goodreads will tell you that this is book number two, but there's a 0.5 book. Which is an early novella, but it was written, I think, after the first book, and it's a prequel. And I think the novella should just be skipped for now, and we'll tell you when to read the novella.
Yeah, it's on our list. Just read No Rest for the Wicked. That's where we are.
Exactly. So if you have gummed it up, you can stop now, go read No Rest for the Wicked, and then come back to us, because we'll be here waiting for you. We're infinitely patient people, and we will always have something to say about these books. So, No Rest for the Wicked, which is the second in the series, and it is the story of another vampire, but this one's a male vampire, and already I have a lot to say about vampires, and another Valkyrie, and this is obviously a female Valkyrie. Are there male... Is it possible to have a male Valkyrie?
I don't think so. And one of the things that's really interesting about this book is that it really advances like these two groups. I think our understanding of like all of the backstory of the vampires and the Valkyries and why they don't like each other. And I think you get hints. You just get a flavor of that in book number one. But this now, I think it narrows into really exploring these two groups and not only how they interact with each other, but how they interact with their own immortality. So I think this book is kind of interesting in that it doesn't necessarily really advance the accession story, which gets introduced, like that this is coming. I think instead it does a better job of introducing us to the players, right? It's not a plot book. It's a player's book.
Yes, exactly. And I also think, and I said this at the end of the last episode, but the first book really felt like Cressley was still sort of working out the paranormal voice. This is her first paranormal series. It's her first foray into an incredibly big world. And I think this book is the first book where we really see... In the last book, we start to see like hints of this other world. But this is the first book where we actually see pieces of that other world laid down as set pieces and kind of signposts for where the rest of the series is going to go. And I think that's what makes this so great. I think this is actually where I mean, I love this series so much, but when I really fell for this series was this Amazing Race storyline, which we're getting into and which will take several books to work itself out. And I think that the other thing that I have really been, I didn't know when I was reading that this was why I was so entertained by it, but I have always loved romances where it's a series of romances that are all happening at the same time.
Yes. And I think it does this really well. I think that, and there's a couple other times where we get these like overlapping kind of books where things that are happening, you get this hint of what's happening in one book and a weighted glance and a look across the room, and all that becomes so much more meaningful than when you read the next book, right? Like you get those layers and layers.
Yeah, because you start to see the craftsmanship of the story. You start to see how thoughtful she's being when she's putting all of this down on paper. And presumably she didn't know, and this is a question that we'll ask, but she didn't know how big this story would be. And she's already laying the groundwork for it to be immense, which is what it is now.
I think it also, though, shows some of the limits of the world building. And we can talk a little bit more about that later. That especially now that, like, we see the 18 books, like, there's some things here where I'm like, this is, I don't know, I don't want to necessarily get into it right now, but I'm making a mental note to talk about that too. Before we start, though, talking about the book, I have a question for you, which is, did you watch or are you a fan of the TV show The Amazing Race? Because I'm not, and I'm wondering if that makes a difference in your reading of this, that I'm not going to have that, like, cultural moment that you might have.
I have seen a few episodes of The Amazing Race. I'm not an Amazing Race, you know, aficionado, but I love the conceit of it. And it will come as no surprise to you as somebody who's read my books or to anybody who's read my books, that I really like pop culture echoes in my romance novels. I love them in my historicals. And so for me, The Amazing Race really worked. That side of things really worked. Also, it does such a good job of moving the plot forward in a really straight shot, which I love.
Yes. And I think, number one, that's a really nice transition to us talking about the Valkyries as a race of women, because their obsession with pop culture, I think, really intersects with yours. But I also would like to say that, like, I think the thing that's interesting is the advancing of the plot, but also the way that each of these stops, each of these places that they go and the dangers that they meet up with are also really symbolic. And I enjoyed sort of reading that part, right? Like, when we get Catherine, well, I'm getting ahead of myself, but I think that that's the other thing where you really start to see the mastery, that, like, so many layers are working at once. It's working as symbol, it's working as plot, it's working as action, it's working as character development. And to see that all stacked up, it's really something else.
I totally agree. And also, I think that there are some really thoughtful choices here in terms of using the pop culture references to echo what we've been talking about and what you sort of brought up so thoughtfully last episode about modernity being such an important piece of this puzzle, because I want to talk about this hero in light of the last hero as a foil for and also a partner to the last hero in some ways. But we are definitely getting ahead of ourselves. Let's talk about what this book is about. Let's do a quick plot overview.
Okay, so I think, why don't you let me do it? You did it last time. I'm not sure I'll be as good. Well, let me try it and then we'll decide if I'm up to the task.
Have at it.
Catherine the Cold-Hearted is our Valkyrie heroine, and she is she's mentioned in the last book. She's one of Emma's aunts, and she is this fierce warrior who is so well known for hunting vampires that she then breaks off their fangs and puts them on a necklace. And at some point in the first book, I think Emma says that, like, this thing now stretches, like, across rooms of Valhall. And she is called by some town, like, villagers in a little Russian town to come and rid the, like, castle near them of this vampire that they're all really afraid of.
Yeah, but who seems to not really be much of a problem.
Yes, exactly.
They're not exactly the most brave humans you've ever met. He's like a quiet dude in a castle, but for sure, like, a vampire.
I definitely assumed the Hand of Nyx played a part in this call to her.
Oh,
right?
Yeah, of
it's
course.
Not really explicitly stated, but you're right. There's zero reason for them to actually, like, stir this up. So I'm assuming it's just the Hand of Fate, right? And that being Nyx. Nyx is almost always the Hand of Fate. So anyway, she arrives and she's kind of like gonna kill this guy. His name's Sebastian. And when she gets there, he's like a sad vampire sitting in his sad, lonely vampire library reading books. And he's kind of like, have you come to kill me? And she's like, yes, why aren't you putting up a fight? And instead of killing him, she ends up making out with him. And he is very quickly realizes that this thing that he's been told that because, oh my God, I'm doing a terrible job at this.
You're not. It's great. It's delicious. Well, she begins to make out with him. And then
yes,
he discovers
it's his fated mate.
Yeah.
And I will say this to me is one of, it's in the first chapter, one of the most memorable scenes is his, she bloods him, right? So we get this whole new look at what happens to a male vampire when he meets his fated mate, which is called his bride.
Right, because as of right now, we've spent time with a female vampire who, if you'll remember from last book, female vampires are thought to not exist. So she's like special in a remarkable way. And so this is the first time that we've really like spent time in the head of a male vampire.
And he was turned against his will by his brother. And so he never wanted to be a vampire. He knows very little about vampires. He knows nothing about the lore. And when his heart starts beating, he thinks it's an earthquake. It's this amazing moment where he literally doesn't know what's happening to him because he has not felt his own heartbeat in 300 years. And so he is like, "You're my bride." They make out. And she is really freaked out. Like, she, on the other hand, right? So he is physically brought back to life by her. Meanwhile, she's the cold-hearted. For 1,000 years, she has not felt any emotion. And all of a sudden, she's feeling things again. So he brings her emotionally to life. We see this again, this like mirroring of like what their dilemmas are. We saw it with Emma and Lachlan, and we see it again, only this time it's layers and layers and layers. And this is like the first one, and it's really what's on the surface, right? I'm physically brought back to life by you. I have an erection. My heart is beating again. I feel the blood literally rushing through my body. And for her, it's, "I'm feeling feelings. I haven't felt anything in 1,000 years. And both of them are just knocked out by this whole interchange. Like, I mean, it's just like watching two toddlers run into walls.
But I think what's really interesting here, and I feel like we could spend an entire episode just talking about these two and this meeting, because I think this meeting is so representative of so many interesting things that play out through the series and through the book. But the first thing that I have a few thoughts on this that I want to talk about. One is the fact that she is cold and unfeeling, and he makes her feel by brute sort of force, in the sense that he's not in charge of it, but like she can't resist it. Like, it just happens. Like, as much as she would choose, if Catherine had her choice, she would choose not to feel.
Absolutely.
Because she is so deeply traumatized by the events of her past. So just to go back a little bit in terms of her story, it's a very similar story to, oh my God, hero of the last book is
Lachlan.
Lachlan, thank you. To Lachlan's, where we have seen, so, and I want to sort of put a pin in vampires in general, because this is the second time that we're seeing vampires represented as like the pure evil of a world, right? So Lachlan had been tortured and chained in mystical chains, and we have Catherine, who 1,000 years ago was in a massive battle during an accession, during the war, she had sympathy toward a vampire, a young vampire who she was about to kill in battle, and then she took pity on him and let him live, only to have him murder her two sisters.
Right.
And in that moment, she vowed to cut down vampires whenever she approached them. Whenever she stumbled upon them, and she also vowed never to feel again. She lost her emotion.
Now, here's the thing that's amazing. This is now like the second, you've just identified sort of the second mirror image, right? So one is he's physically awakened, she's emotionally awakened. Here's the second one. She feels she has wronged her sisters, whereas he was wronged by his brother. So there's this other sense where she feels that she betrayed them by, you know, like she did them wrong and their death is her fault. Whereas Sebastian did not want to be turned by his brother, and his brother overrode him and did it anyway against his wishes. So we also have this, like, that's the other second sort of mirror image is, I was betrayed by my sibling. I betrayed my siblings.
And at the same time, both characters, because you can't have a romance novel where two people are you know, completely foiled by each other, foils to each other. So what's really fascinating, though, is that technically both of them were turned by vampires, right?
Yes.
Vampires did both of them wrong. And something that we haven't talked about is that Sebastian is a special kind of vampire. He's what's called a forebear, which means he is a turned vampire. Somebody, and there are natural born vampires, and they have a whole set of rules, which we know about. Emma is a natural born vampire in the first book. She can't lie. You know, she can drink blood from the vein. No, she can't. Can she?
Well, it's the difference is the forebears choose to not drink blood from the vein, right? They forebear, right? They forebear from that act.
Right, because we know that drinking blood from the vein, if you kill someone, you can go mad, which is sort of a setup for many other characters in this series. So, but then the other piece of this is when you are a turned vampire, part of you're basically considered lesser in the lore, and so the rest of the immortals, the ones who did not start out human, kind of love. Keeping them in the dark.
It's like a massive game of knowledge keep away. Yes. None of the forebears really know anything about the lore. So when Sebastian starts learning, he doesn't even know what she is. He has no idea that Valkyries are real. And in fact, there's this really hilarious exchange where he says to her, like, I thought you'd be bigger, like taller. And she's like, what is that supposed to mean? Right? And he's like, well, that's the story. And she's like, look, if you had your ass handed to you by a 5'5" woman, wouldn't you instead tell everyone this story about how big and bruising, you know, they were? And he's like, right on. Good point.
Yeah. Well, so this is where I'm at, is there are all these moments where you see the two of them are the same and then also incredibly different. But basically, vampires took both of their lives, in the sense that a vampire took her sister's and her emotions, and his brother, a vampire, took his choice.
Yeah.
His life and his choice, and turned him into a vampire against his wishes. He says, this happens in the first chapter, he says, I don't want this. And his brother, thinking that he's doing right, turns him into a vampire anyway. So here we have two people, one of whom is a creature that both of whom hate the creature that Sebastian is. But Sebastian sort of has to live in his skin as something that he doesn't love. And what I really want to talk about here, though, is this idea that he makes her feel, because it feels like it flips the whole romance paradigm on its head, which we're going to see over and over again in this series. But it is until sort of this moment, it feels like, in romance, I'm not sure there are that many. And I've been thinking about this all day. I'm not sure there are that many romances prior to this where it is the heroine who has to be taught to feel again.
I mean, it's interesting because that trope about being frigid is not about emotions. It's about sexual, like, right? And I mean, so we yes and no, like, yes, right? We get emotional women who are sort of like locked away, or like can't access their sexuality, but we very rarely see a heroine who is emotionally cold, and that's like her primary, right? Like, it does. And then the flip side, the other character is one who's had their consent taken away from them, right? So yes, there's definitely some, like, what feels like kind of gender swapping for these classic tropes, where she's then instead like the cold kind of alpha, I'll kick your ass, and he's the one who's like, I'm just sort of sad and feeling sad for myself in my sad house. That's very different.
I mean, he's also sexually repressed, quite literally.
Absolutely. Absolutely he is.
The twist, the flip, and Valkyries are so, while Catherine may not be, you know, as sexually confident and as sort of interested in emotion as the rest of the coven of Valkyries. The reality is that Valkyries are deeply emotional, and I want to talk about that in a bit too, but we'll get there.
Yeah, so actually, no, let's do it now, because I want to talk about Valkyries. I want to talk about the Valkyries as a group of people, because Katarin is of them, but really different from them. And the deal with her, like, not feeling emotions is, and it, I did not pay as much attention to this until I reread it, is they are the amazing race that they're part of, this thing called the Talisman High, is hosted by the goddess of impossibility. Her name is Riora. And there's, and I really paid more attention to this time around. And the reveal, and I think we've decided, right, to just be spoilerific now. We're not going to really try and withhold this, is that Katarin didn't really ever know why she lost her emotions. Like, something happened and she was grateful for it. Then there's this really fascinating throwaway line where Katarin thinks about the things that could kill a Valkyrie. And it's like beheadings, a mystical assassination, or sorrow.
Mm-hmm.
Just being really sad is enough to kill a Valkyrie. And later on in the book, Riora essentially reveals that she's the one who took Katarin's emotion. She didn't really mean to take away all her emotions, but that Katarin's sorrow about the deaths of her twins, like her two sisters, they were triplets, that was so destabilizing to the entire group of Valkyries, the whole 12 covens, that but she was too strong to die. She, like, right, so her sorrow was debilitating, but she was too strong to die from it, and so Riora had to step in to essentially, like, contain this sorrow that was going to be enough to sink every Valkyrie in the world. That's how powerful her sadness was.
And how powerful the Valkyries are.
Yes.
And I think that that's what struck me. Again, this is not a book that I've read. I don't think I've reread this since the first time that I read it. And one of the really powerful things this time, just like last week when we were talking about the first book in light of the world and the Kavanaugh hearings, this book just felt like it just hit me over and over and over again how powerful these women are. And it felt really rewarding to me to read this book where she and her sisters, her Valkyrie sisters and cousins, etc., are really the most powerful group of immortals that we've interacted with so far. And we will meet other powerful immortals, but the Valkyries feel like, to a woman, they are incredibly powerful. Versus, I think when we meet the other characters in the series, when we meet the witches or we meet the demons or we meet the fae, we start to see there's an ebb and flow of power among them, but all the Valkyries are immensely powerful. And this idea that you could bring down the world with your sorrow felt very empowering to me.
Oh, absolutely. It did. It really did. I felt the same way. I read past these, right? Like, I didn't have a real strong feeling either way about this one, but as rereading it, I was really drawn into the emotional lives of these two characters who have been so removed from the world, right? Like, there's a powerful interiority to kind of both of them. And then when they, like, kind of run into each other, it's kind of painful to watch in some ways, because as hard as they're trying to make these connections, they don't have the basic skills to even talk to each other, really, right? And so there's all these ways in which, you know, I talked about, like, action being what builds these characters, and yet action sort of fails them too. And so I really, the amazing race is such a perfect metaphor for their literal journey, right? Like, not just around the world to these places, but that they have to figure out how to be together. That's not something either of them have any skills for at all.
No, and it's also an issue with them, and I think this is a book where I feel like these are two characters who take from each other a lot, and in ways that are both incredibly powerful and really devastating. And there are moments that I was really sad. And maybe that's the point, but there's actually the moment where so Sebastian is a vampire. Like we said, he's never taken from the vein. He's never bitten a human. And there is a moment where they're having sort of a sexual moment, and he bites her accidentally. And he doesn't bite her. He scrapes her with a fang, and she bleeds, and he tastes her blood, and he is instantly both incredibly, full of pleasure and also just devastated that he did this thing to her, both because he's always promised himself that he would never do it. He's been a part of he hasn't really been part of a community, but the community that he was part of sort of makes this verboten, but then also because she is so angry with him and he doesn't know the implications of what he's done, because he's not smart, right? He's not part of, and by that I mean like he's not smart. He's not wise to the way of the lore. And so he doesn't know what's about to happen to him, right? So he tastes her blood. He drinks from her, and then he inherits her memories, and he can see what he's taken from her over and over again, right? He can see the vampires took from her and that he's taken from her, and he can feel her anger and he understands it. And it's a devastating scene that I think is really beautifully written, because at the same time, there's this flip of what she seems to be taking from him by virtue of the amazing race and what is to be won from it.
Well, and I think one of the things that I found, like, so in book one, we talk a lot about, and Emma talks a lot about, it's about finding your strength and being an immortal, right? But these are two characters who really, it's about pain, right? There's a point, I think, where someone says, like, I can live forever, but that doesn't mean I don't experience pain. Or, she and Regan have this really interesting conversation, and it's in Antarctica. And I don't think that's a mistake, right? Like, this is the moment where she is coldest to him. She's met him, but determined to freeze him out, right? And the landscape, like, matches her will. And she says to Regan essentially something like, it's better to, like, forego a moment's worth of happiness to prevent this future pain. And they're talking at that point about Regan. There's this, like, hint that about who Regan's mate will be, and that this is someone from her past that's going to be reincarnated. But they have this moment where they understand this together. But I think that's exactly right. Like, the first book was really all about kind of, like, who am I? And the second one is, like, how can I live with this?
Exactly. And I think that's a really, that goes back to what we were talking about before about the book, this book being, the first book is the first book in the line of Immortals After Dark, but this is the first book of the series, it feels.
Yes, right. Right, absolutely. I could see that, right? Like, it's, the setup is done, right? And now it's time to, like, make it happen. And I think, I think I use the phrase, like, virtue signaling. And this is really, like, further signaling to me that she's interested in putting, like, heroes and heroines in positions they don't typically inhabit and seeing what happens. And she's really also interested in exploring characters who, and I'd sort of written this down, it's kind of like, what can you accept about each other and what you have to accept about yourself? And we saw that last time too, but I think we see that again and again and again in this series. Okay. One of the things I'm noticing is, like, we laughed a lot more last time, and it's not that this book is without humor. Like, one thing that really made me laugh is there's this part at the beginning where Cannerin tells him, like, there's three big turnoffs, she says. And the first one is, don't crowd me. Right. And he's like, but what are the rest of them? And she's like, work on number one for a while. Right. And then, like, we, and you know, I'm kind of reading along, like, what's the next one? And then it's essentially the same one later. It's like, don't pressure me. Right. So she, it's like one and two are very similar. But then there's this hilarious part at the end after they finally, like, have sex and he kind of disappears. It's against his will. He doesn't really mean to. He doesn't even know how long she's gone. And then she tells him that the third rule, the third big turnoff, is not calling, which is really in direct opposition with rules one and two. But I think that goes back to that whole, all the things in this book are playing with what's both possible and impossible. And so lots of things that seem like they would be totally in conflict with each other somehow magically work. And I think we're meant to understand that it's Riora's impact on this kind of closed system of their relationship that makes this happen. So there are things that happen in this book that never happen again. For example, Sebastian figures out how to trace directly to her, when for the entire rest of the lore and all the vampires and tracing beings, it's you can only trace to places you've been before. We never see this again, that anyone else can do it. And I think it's clear because it's Riora that the impossible is possible, right? There's a really funny part where, you know, or even the whole time travel, like, which I just find very tedious. I was like, time travel, you know, who cares, right?
Well, I mean, I'm just going to pause there because I think we should talk about I think we should just explain what we're talking about when we talk about The Amazing Race and what we mean by time travel. So there is an Amazing Race every 200 and something years, and Catherine has won it for, I don't know,
four or five times, right?
Yeah, four or five times in a row. And this is because she lacks emotion, right? So she's able to just be cold and get it done. And the way Riora sets it up is this, she puts together, it's basically a scavenger hunt. Like, you go, the more complicated things on, like, the top of Everest or whatever are more points. The person with the most points at the finals, the person with the most points at the end wins a prize that is desired by everyone. And this goes back to, we've talked about this before, but this question of, what could an immortal, all of these people are incredibly rich. They know everything. They have everything. They don't die. Whatever they want is theirs. What's fascinating about this is that in this particular case, the question is, well, what could, I imagine Cressley sat down and was like, well, what could an immortal possibly want? And if you are immortal and have lived forever and will live forever, it seems like the only thing you could possibly want is the chance to go back in time and change something, and reset your fate.
Nicely said, yes.
And so... And Catherine wants this more than anything because she has seen her sisters die. She knows that if she did not hesitate and she did strike down that vampire, her sisters would not have died in that moment. She can pick the exact moment that her life changed. Interestingly, Sebastian also has a moment that he can point to and say, if I went back to that moment, everything would change.
But it's interesting. He has nothing tied up in winning this item. It's just called Thrain's Key, because he doesn't believe it will really work,
which is his humanity, his flawed small brain, right? Again, there is a really interesting piece here that this is the second hero we've met who has who is struggling with a world beyond what he knows,
and yet he is an intellectual, right? So the Valkyries are obsessed with pop culture and video games and, you know, all the things that are changing. He shuts himself away. And there's a part, for example, where it says, like, he'd read about how airplanes worked, but he'd never been on one. Right. And so he is fully aware of what's going on in the world, but has decided to not interact with it in any way. And I think that that's really meaningful, again, for this, you know, again, it's like this difference between she's all action and he's all contemplation. He's like been sitting around thinking for 300 years, but that all that it's all intellectual without any real. It's, you know, it's just all, it's like what, you know, what you'd say is like, you know, they're book smart, but not street smart.
Mm-hmm. But also it's a question of he's not street smart as a vampire, or he's not book smart as a vampire either. He doesn't know anything about this world. The only thing he knows is how to close his eyes and trace directly to the woman who is his bride.
Right. And he knows how to fight. Because he was, yeah. He was a, you know, big badass Estonian general or something.
Yeah, well, and I gotta say, the one thing I didn't say about that scene where he drinks from her the first time is that it comes immediately after a fencing scene, and we all know how much I love fencing scenes.
Word.
But they have like a full sword fight, and it's delightful.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and it's part of his like letting go of this old school, like, you know, he just assumes he's gonna kick her ass because he's a man and she's a woman. And then he realizes, I mean, his understanding of how ferocious she really is and the cruelty to which she seems capable of. And what he really wonders is, and again, I felt like this was very like turning sort of these gender roles on his head, was him thinking, I'm going to have to be meaner myself if I want to capture this one, because I don't have a chance if I'm like Mr. Nice Guy.
Yeah, exactly. He's changing for her from the very beginning of this book. I mean, from page one when she meets him and he's sort of a sad wet noodle. He's constantly, he's literally a wet noodle.
I know. Poor
baby.
Do
you see what I mean about wet noodle? Do you get it?
I get it, Sarah. I'm like, oh, Sarah.
No, he's literally like, and the moment he meets her, he's instantly sort of manned.
Right. Literally.
Which is fascinating. It's just There's just a fascinating play of character here, because she is so incredibly strong, and he really is like he could be a Mary Sue.
Yeah, I think what's fascinating is this to me.
Like,
is he a virgin? No, but he had some bad.
No, I was gonna say, is he a beta? Like, are we looking at a beta hero here? And maybe we are.
Yeah. You know what's interesting is
is it you I had that beta conversation with where I was like, Cressley's written betas?
And we were both like, what? And I don't know. I think that might have been some crazy Twitter thing.
It was the vampire chained to a bed later in the series.
Yeah.
And you were like, let's not start people looking for betas with Cressley.
You know what's interesting? And I like Sebastian's fine, but Catherine is the star of this show. And sure. Often looking back at books when I haven't reread them recently, I will say I love her heroines. I love them. And it's not that he is he loves her and that feels real. And she deserves someone who's just like nice and solid and steady. But there's not much. I mean, even he has his alpha tendencies, but I did not find him as compelling a hero as some of her other heroes.
No, because, well, I know what kind of heroes you like. And I think, but I do think if you are listening and you are not a paranormal reader typically, and you aren't sure about this because, you know, I mean, the hero of our first foray into this chews off his own foot.
Although at the end, Sebastian has to take off his own arm. And I was like, enough with the amputations in this series. It is enough. It needs to stop now.
It ain't gonna stop.
Oh, my God. I'm like, heavy-handed metaphors.
But I really actually do think that Sebastian is a really lovely hero.
Oh, yeah.
I think if you are interested in a softer hero, this is probably as close to a cinnamon roll as Cressley is going to get.
Sure. Yes, that's true. You're like,
not a cinnamon roll.
But he's, I mean, as close as she's going to get, yes, that is a true statement. But, you know, this is also a guy who later on, when he thinks that she's, you know, with this other man, he like drags her down a hallway and like they, like he, it's consensual, she's into it, but he like realizes she's not wearing underwear and is basically like, let me just get some fingers up in there. I mean, he is like, right?
There's nothing wrong with that.
No, obviously. But it's like a really amazing, I mean, that's when you really see that he still that's all like built into his system too, right? Like his possessiveness and his sense that, you know, but it's, I don't think he thinks he does, that he is owed her. I think he thinks he has to win her. And that's how he's different than Lachlan to me.
In fact, he says that. He articulates that.
Yeah.
And she says at some point, they're talking and he says, you know, I love being with you. Like he has this moment where, and it's so honest and real, and it feels like a conversation you would have with just a normal human person who you are attracted to. And he says, I enjoy being with you. And she says, you have to like being with me. I'm your bride, right? She gives herself up to the lore. She says, you know, this is part of it. Everything is fated. And he says, this is the quote. He says, of course, it's mystical compulsion that's making me so attracted to you and not the fact that you gave me a good look at how your mind works and I admired what I saw.
I know. He loves her brain.
And I just, that's all. We just want to be seen,
yes,
fellas.
Yes. You know what else, though? I think the other big change for him, and so, okay, there's a lot of really interesting things about fate that we should talk to, because it's the name of our podcast, and also, but just like really important to the book. So I really, one of the key things for understanding the Valkyries is they believe absolutely in fate. And so then there's this really interesting part where Mist, who's another Valkyrie, is talking to Catarin, and she says something along the lines of, like, Sebastian is, he's sort of like a death before dishonor kind of guy. He doesn't understand that you should do anything for the ones you love. And I found myself thinking a lot about this, because if you believe that the hand of fate is going to rule everything, then why wouldn't you do everything for the people you love? It's going to turn out the way it is anyway, but at least then they know how you feel about them, right? And it's not, but it's not until the very end that he comes around to that way of thinking, where he understands, like, I just have to show her that I love her and leave this up to fate, because that's all I can do. And that's when he like wins her over and wins me over, by the way, right? I mean, I think his sacrifice at the end, which is essentially his willingness to, you know, he's like, okay, we're going to use this key to go back and save your sisters. But he fully understands that it means I might never be a part of your life, right? Like your whole history will be rewritten if we do this. And he does it anyway because he loves her. And he... And it, you really believe it. I really found myself believing that he was going to take that risk for her.
Oh, well, I mean, of course he was. And that's the covenant, right, of the romance hero, is that ultimately he will sacrifice the one thing he wants the most in the world for the happiness of the heroine.
Right.
And in this particular case, part of the reason why this book works so well is because the one thing he wants in the world is the heroine, right? So... by giving her up, by sacrificing his desire for her so that she will be happy, I mean, that's all any of us ever want, right?
It's so simple. It's so easy.
Exactly. I mean, Eric has never done that. He eats all the cookies in the middle of the night.
I could tell you the most romantic thing that Daryl ever did for me, but he'd be really mad at me. I'll tell you off of the podcast. But it really, okay. But it was amazing. And it's like the most romantic thing anyone's ever done for me.
Well, I look forward to hearing that.
Yes, of course you do.
But also, I think that there is a question here of, again, this is the story of family.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
family on a number of levels. And I love, so one thing I want to talk about that we haven't talked about yet is sex and the vampire and the, no.
I'm like, we haven't talked about sex yet? Fail.
One thing that we haven't talked about yet is this kind of emotion and the Valkyries, the lightning.
Yes.
I want to talk about, because I think this is also Cressley putting a stake in the ground on women and sex. I think, so a couple things are interesting here. One, this is the first book where we start to see about birth control and the Valkyries. Meaning as long as a Valkyrie doesn't eat, she can't get pregnant, which is a really nice, tidy way.
Well, and it means no one ever has to go to the bathroom and you know, and I,
right. But it's also a very clear statement on women and sex and, being able to sort of put women in charge of their own sexuality and a woman in charge of her own body. Valkyries are fully in charge. You cannot impregnate a Valkyrie unless she chooses to be impregnated.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And that's pretty fabulous.
And it's literally electric, right? Like the whole, like they produce lightning when they are really emotionally or sexually charged. And meanwhile, the scene where they like, they're flying in a plane and it's like all lightning outside. And I was like, wait, this seems ill-advised. Perhaps you should get on the ground.
It's fine. You know, here's a science thing, science friend. Planes are built to withstand lightning.
Well, there you go.
So I know that for a fact because I'm terrified of flying. So now I know everything about flying. but the lightning thing is really interesting, right? Because it's not just lightning. It's not just sex. It's emotion.
Oh,
in
yes,
general,
absolutely.
Right. So there's this. So you know, obviously, since we're doing spoilers. So aside from sex, right? So there is the moment. The first moment that we actually see the lightning. Well, I think we see it in the book before, but the first moment we really see Valkyrie lightning here is when she is at the, they're in this hidden away cavern that is the temple of Riora, and you have to know how to get there to get there. You have to know it exists and know how to get there because it's hidden. And he turns up in this cavern and she is so moved by him being in her vicinity that lightning starts to crash all around the temple, and everyone knows that Catarin the Cold-Hearted is feeling something because Valkyries are unable to hide their emotions, which feels again very much like women in the world, like women and their silly emotions, except a Valkyrie's emotions can bring down the world. And then when ultimately Sebastian makes his sacrifice, and we get to a place where Catarin dies. I mean, she falls into fire, right?
It's suicidal almost, right?
Well, she says, you bring me back.
Yes, and then we'll bring them back, right? The key will work twice.
They need, one of them needs to die in order for them to get the key.
And so it's this moment of trust, right? Where she knows that and this is when you like this, you know, these two crazy kids, it's all going to work out, right? Like when she trusts him to not only save her, but save her sisters, right? So his sacrifice, like she's sacrificing too, right? Like, and one of the things, I mean, this trust, it's fascinating. And you and I were sort of talking about this earlier, but I really wanted us to talk about it is, you know, there's a thing that sort of happens in Romancelandia where people get frustrated with books where it's miscommunication that causes the problems. Like, why didn't they just sit down and talk about it? And I understand that. And I've said that myself. I'm not saying I haven't. But I also realize it's incredibly difficult to have a perfect conversation every time. And Catarin and Sebastian are constantly like saying the wrong thing to each other, right? Like, you know, he'll sort of say something and be like, ooh, and he can't take it back because she's so mad and she gets furious. So this moment where she trusts him And she knows he's going to do exactly what she needs him to do. Whereas up in, you know, and earlier in the book, she's like, you know, I don't trust you. You love your leverage, right? This is this really important moment where she's like, okay, I'm going to give myself up to this, these feelings I have for him and trust him. And then this then furthers the trust he has in her, right? Like, and that's really this moment where, you know, it's both words and action together that get them through.
And on top of it, there is this sense of her trust in him just being an extension of her power, right? I mean, in order to trust him as much as she does and throw herself into fire, sacrifice herself into fire so that she can, they can, ultimately, she's still doing this for her sisters, right? She's still making these choices for her sisters, but she's trusting him to love her enough to go with her on this journey, right? Which I think goes back to your issue of, you know, the Valkyries leave everything up to fate because she believes they are fated to be together because she is his bride. And therefore, he will support her in whatever it is, whatever endeavor she has, right? It never occurs to her that she, that he might not be there to help her get her sisters back.
Right. Well, and I think that's why it's important that it's fire, right? Like, so remember, it's all symbolic, right? Like, she's freezing him out in Antarctica, but now it's this like literal river of fire. And so we see this progression from like cold-hearted Catherine to like, I'm going to give myself up to this thing that like, I'm literally like that version of me is going to be gone forever when I come back.
Right.
Right.
And then she comes back to discover that Riora has basically made the deal more complicated, which is to say that if they do go back in time and save her sisters, Sebastian will lose her because she'll be happy and she'll never come to his castle. And that'll be that.
Right. And we knew that was coming all along. Like, I didn't even, at that point, I didn't need that emotionally. I felt like the big emotional payoff was this scene where she like lets go. Right. But also,
really, that's really interesting.
Well, partly because I think I always, and this is back to like the time travel thing, I'm always like, yeah, nah, time travel. I don't know. Like, right. It just is not a trope that I find really.
Yeah.
Right. Like it always is somebody, I don't know, like if I think about it too hard, my brain starts to hurt. I'm like,
sure. But the crafting of that scene, right? The crafting of that arc of the sort of arc of the dark moment there is really powerful because what you see is Riora saying to Sebastian, okay, so here's the deal. You can make her happy or you can make you happy. And which is it going to be? And I mean, of course, we know he's going to choose her. We know he is. But the like powerful sort of heart-wrenching moment there is the awareness that like she won't be happy without him. And he still isn't 100% sure about that. And this goes back to your point last episode about how it's never the females who are fully fated. They don't. It's like the females have to choose. The females of the lore have to choose their mates rather than the males of the lore who are sort of gifted their mates. And so the males are never 100% certain. And part of the joy of that as a reader is that you don't want your hero to be 100% certain of the heroine. You want him to fight for her always.
Right. Well, and there's this great, I mean, back to the whole like conversational moment. So there's like this, one of my favorite moments in this book actually is, and I think that's why, like, I didn't need the big sweeping moments in this book. It's, like, the little moments that tickled me. And there's this part where it's after, you know, he thinks she's gone off with this, like, Colombian drug lord or whatever. And she says to him, I wasn't really going to go with him. And he was like, I don't know, he says something like, well, okay, if you say so. And she's like, well, I do. And he's like, no, you're supposed to convince me. You're supposed to, like, listen to me and understand how upset I am. And I really found, like, those moments to be like, I don't know, there's so many tiny little like steps that when we get to the end, of course we know he's going to do what she needs to do. It didn't feel surprising. It felt inevitable. And that doesn't mean it wasn't pleasing to me, right? It's just that it was, I don't know. Like, I knew all along what was, I don't know.
You knew they were going to get together all along.
It was going to be a happily ever after. I'm not sure how I knew that exactly. But yeah, I don't know. Like, those moments, like the big sort of like, now we're going to go back and save your sisters. Of course they were, right? Like, and again, maybe that's the whole, like, she set it all up for that to happen. I knew that he would do it. It could not have been any other way.
Well, of course.
Right.
Or else he just wouldn't be a valuable hero.
Right. I really want to talk about the sharks.
Talk about the sharks, man.
Okay. So, all right. I don't know. Maybe this is off topic a little bit, but the whole thing where she dives into shark infested waters that are, it's like essentially full of, like, there's a meatpacking plant up the river. I was like, what is this, Chicago 1850? Stop and tell you a little story about Chicago. The meatpacking industry in Chicago, right? There's a whole neighborhood called Back of the Yards. It was like the Union Stockyards. And part of the Chicago River was called Bloody Creek because they would, like, essentially shovel out all the, like, pieces they couldn't use in making meat into this one part of the Chicago River that was, like, so thick with, like, blood and scum that you could, like, walk across it. Oh, so disgusting. So this whole moment, though, where she is like, I'm gonna go out and get this thing and I'm gonna swim through shark infested waters and fight with a shark, I don't know, like, her bravery at that moment was so unreal to me because she doesn't know where he is. And she's still like, I am going to go and I don't care where he is. I'm heartbroken. Where is he? Why hasn't he called me? And it's really, again, like, metaphorically, this moment where she's like, I don't care. I have to keep going. I'm in shark infested waters and I have to keep going. And then he does show up to save her, but she needed saving. And mm-hmm. it didn't bother me at that moment at all that she didn't save herself. And I can't quite figure out why.
Because she saves herself constantly. She seems, I mean, that's the thing, is we talk so much now in romance about how the heroine has to save herself and the heroine has to be the savior. And I mean, that's what I write, right? I write heroines who ultimately save the hero. But the reality is that when you write a strong heroine who's saving herself all the time, then you've established for the reader that she's okay. And so when she really is in a really dangerous pickle,
yeah,
the hero is going to come in and he's going to save her. And he's going to get the points for being noble and he's going to get the points for being heroic. And the reader is going to be overjoyed because they have an incredibly strong heroine and a hero who is her match.
Right. Okay.
And that's the joy of this. That's the joy of this whole series, is that I think there isn't a single book in this series where they're not really beautifully matched at the end of the book.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I would just say also this question of the rest of the series kind of being tied into this book is really fascinating to me, because I have a really difficult time believing that Cressley was already thinking about 18 books.
Mm-mm. Right.
But there are just so many threads on the page in this book that are there to be picked up later in the series.
And threads that are still unwoven, right? Like, there's so many questions I have. Like, so in the first book, I feel like kind of lots of things get wrapped up. But in the second book, there are, like, lists of things where, like, we get way more about Fury, right? And she is still out there, still drowning every day.
And there are gods and goddesses.
Yes.
That are asleep. So all the Valkyrie's main parents are asleep.
We get at the very end, we get Sebastian with an opportunity to go back and perhaps, like, save his sisters or see them again. And we don't know if he ever did that. We get, there's lists and lists of fascinating magical items in this that are revealed in the Talisman High that don't ever come into play again, but certainly could. Right?
And a bunch of lists, a bunch of talismans. I did have a moment as a writer where I was like, oh, this is so smart. Because there are a bunch of things that Kaidoran has already won.
Yes.
That are in the possession of the Valkyries. And presumably at any time, one could turn up as a useful tool in the middle of a battle.
Or a useful weapon to be used against them, right? And so, yeah, like, you've introduced all of these, like, free agents into the system that at any point can just come right back.
It's really remarkable. One of the challenges, I think, with paranormal romance in general is that this sort of suspension of disbelief and the world building have to really tie together well. Mm-hmm. Because if a world is built poorly, a reader is going to see the scars on it and see the marks where things aren't stitched together well. And the reality is that what Cressley is doing right now, even in the last book, she was laying things down on the page so that ultimately if something were to happen and she were to sort of deus ex machina, if she were to deus ex machina, the kind of, yeah, if she were to bring one back in as sort of a, oh, but don't forget that we have this magic key that takes us back in time, you know?
Right.
Nobody would say anything because it's been there the whole time.
Right.
And it's just smart. It's just smart writing. It's smart planning as a writer. And she couldn't have possibly known on book two of this series that it would go on and that we would be making a podcast of it.
Oh,
later.
I know. Absolutely. Well, I mean, or even like Kaidoran's sisters, like, they're so vital to this story, but I don't know if we ever see them again. Right? Like,
I guess we don't.
Right? Like, they're just living in Valhall now, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, they're just extra Valkyries.
they're like spares, right? But I mean, and that sort of, let me say the one thing that I don't want to call it a disappointment, right? But I think it's like maybe it's the time or maybe it's whatever. I don't want to make excuses for it. But this book is where you really start to see it's like very European centric, right? All of the, you know, I'm kind of like, oh, you have all the immortals in the world, but somehow they're all white people. They're all straight. You know, like this is where we, and it takes a long time, I think, for her to expand into some of that in a way that, you know, we only see in like book 17 or whatever, a male couple. And I think part of that is, part of it is the time, but I wish that, you know, Argentina and China and sub-Saharan Africa weren't just like set pieces, but I think those could have been valuable opportunities to bring in interesting characters. And I just have to name that. Like, it is what it is, right? But I think that this is one time I think, you know, okay, all the immortals are like from Scotland and Russia. Cool.
Yeah, it's a problem. I do think as the series goes on, she starts to think about it more.
Yeah.
But it's looking back on it with an eye of 2018.
Sure.
Yeah, it's clear. And so I'm glad that you named it. That's what we're doing, right?
Yeah. And that's, you know what, like I said, it's just, I think it's just noticing it, right? And I don't think I noticed it 15 years ago. Like, we're different now and it's different now. And I think it's just okay to say, I noticed this thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think I'm definitely like, I would like more Dasha and Rika. Maybe they're just, you know, learning all those video games probably takes a lot of time.
It's true.
If their learning curve is anything like mine.
I love the Valkyries so much, though. I love how much they love money. And oh, can we talk about money?
Yes.
We are. I know we're running out of time, but I want to talk about money. I like talking about money.
Oh, who doesn't?
So, interestingly enough, in the last book, we had Lachlan, who was chained in the catacombs and then came up and didn't have any sense of the modern world and didn't have any access to money. And he just started spending all of Emma's money.
Yes.
And in this book, we have Sebastian, who is doing a similar thing in that he is living at one point. He's basically moved into Catherine's London apartment. Mm-hmm. And there's a scene, there's a moment in the book where he actually says, like, he goes there because he likes to sleep there. And he likes to take showers there because the shower's warm and he's been washing himself with cold water and the snow, melted snow. And then he just says, like, these are beautiful things. Like, everything that she has is so beautiful, and living in her apartment is beautiful, and he's really enjoying this new time, this new world, this modernity. We go back to this as an echo. And I think it's really interesting because, like, again, all these dudes are very wealthy. Like, I'm not worried that they, you know, are not going to be able to get a job and take care of themselves. But there is a certain sense in these books of, like, why are these dudes spending all this money for me?
I know. Well, and it's, I mean, I think part of it is, I mean, again, like, romance signals very clearly that, like, the more, I mean, you know, America, right? It's gross, but the more money you have, like, you're the powerful one in the, you're the powerful one in the relationship, the more money you have, right?
But interestingly, these men do not have that problem.
No.
They don't have that moment. And I sort of like that. Okay, now you're making me realize, like, I'm looking at myself in this too, because definitely at the start, I was like, when I started 2 minutes ago talking about this, I felt like, I don't love that they're spending all her money. But then at the same time,
they don't have any problem with them.
They don't. And they're also incredibly powerful women. So, like, why wouldn't they spend their money? And also, money's sort of a non-issue. Again, if you're immortal, you know.
What's money? You've got a...
Money's fine.
Well, I think the other thing, though, is there's a couple things, which is money and worrying about money is a very human... This is a human preoccupation, right? And so they're immortal. So it has to be that their relationship to it is different. It wouldn't make sense for them to worry about money the same way we do, right? Like, it, because their concerns are, like, so much bigger than ours, right? Like, the way they think about time and like, right? Like, it just must seem silly, right? So I think part of it is it's one way to signal that they're just, like, at a different level than us. Mm-hmm. But I think there's also part of me that's like, yeah, they're all still, like, super rich and wearing cashmere sweaters. So it's also a way for us to enjoy, like, the casual wealth of it too, right? Like, I do think paranormal books often kind of want it both ways, right? Like, oh, they don't have to worry about money, so they can just have all this money without worrying about it. And then you can just sort of roll around in it, right?
Well, I mean, if you think about something like J.R. Ward's Black Dagger Brotherhood series, which is, like, constantly name-checking luxury brands, right? Like, everything is a luxurious.
But now it's dated because they're carrying Razor phones, right? So, I mean, I think one of the smart moves here is, like, the Valkyries, like, their love of, like, diamonds is, I actually was like,
a diamond is forever.
Yeah.
Call us, De Beers, if you would like to sponsor our podcast.
The diamond things. No, but you know what's crazy about the diamond thing is I had this thought where I was like, maybe, like, there's a Valkyrie who just, like, works in a jewelry shop. Because she can totally tell just by looking at something if it's, like, a real diamond or, like, cubic zirconia. But I think that, you know, like, Catherine is so, you know, we didn't even really talk about Bowen, who's, like, her big competition. At one point, he, like, dangles this diamond necklace in front of her, and she's like, I really want that, and she literally cannot look away. And this is, it's playing with a thing about how women only want money and diamonds, and yet it's like, it's fascinating. I don't know what to make of
it,
actually.
It's also unapologetic.
Oh, yeah.
Which is kind of amazing. I mean, anybody who knows me knows that I'm pro-Kardashian. And part of the reason why is because those ladies have made millions on the backs of their bodies and their desires and their identity. And I think that's awesome. And I think that the Valkyries are very much that.
Yeah.
Like, that experience of, I do like diamonds and I do like money and I do like video games and gimme. And come at me if you have a problem with it, because I will burn the world down.
Well, and for, I mean, for Sebastian, there's some, a very explicit thing where he's like, why would she want to get with me? I'm a bum. He literally has to like shave and buy clothes and force himself to eat. So there's also this like, almost like I have, you know, again, like, I have to prove my worth. I mean, it like both plays into sort of classic capitalism, but also subverts it. And I can't decide yet, right? Like,
yeah,
me neither. I can't decide yet whether I think it's like working for me.
I'm putting that on our list to come back to on other episodes. But I want to say, next episode, it's happening. So Bowen McCreeve,
yes,
who has been left in a cave in a burning fire pit.
I love that at the end, they're like, oh shit, we left him there for 2 weeks. Oh, well, he's been kind of a dick. Like, leave him in there, right?
So the next book is called Wicked Deeds on a Winter's Night. It is told mostly somewhat in the same time.
Oh, yeah. A lot of overlapping. Yeah.
Mostly an overlap. It's like an 80% overlap of this book. It follows the Talisman High. And Bowen, our werewolf friend, thinks that he has lost. He's basically, he has nothing to live for. He's lost his mate. And there is a young witch, Mariketta the Awaited, who we have met already. She was a part of this high. It is enemies to lovers. He cannot possibly have a second mate because he has lost his first one, and you only get one in a lifetime. Mary and Bowen have to work together.
Yeah.
Even though they hate each
other. Well, and we're going to have a special guest, which is even more exciting, right?
Tell everybody about what they've won.
We have been like talking to all these other authors kind of on the down low. I'm not an author. You've been talking to other authors. I just like come along for the ride. And we're talking to Adriana Herrera, who I wrote a piece with. Actually, that's not true. She did all the work. I asked her interesting questions about domestic violence and romance for the Smart Bitches. And we started chatting and she was like, I love The Immortals After Dark. And we were like, do you want to be on our podcast? So she said, you know, we were like, well, which book is a question? It's really fascinating, actually. Like, which book would you want to talk about? And she immediately said that she would want to talk about this one, about Bowen and Mariketta. So she's going to be our first special guest. And I think we're really excited to see what happens when there's now three of us talking.
When there's three of us. Also, I would say there is a moment at the end of this book, book three. What are we calling it? Book three. We don't even know.
Two. We're on two right now. Next time.
There is a moment at the end of book three that I think is one of the most beautiful hero moments in romance. So I'm real excited to get there and talk about it. All right. That is our show, long though it might be. And we are super excited, you guys. Thanks for coming to our third podcast. We hope you'll join us next time, 2 weeks, with Adriana Herrera, talking about Wicked Deeds on a Winter's Night. Thanks so much.
See you guys next time. Well, let me downshift into something slightly more silly, because, you know, I'm constantly like, what's like the line that made me either like really that made me laugh out loud? And it was Ace McFuckup in A Hunger Like No Other. But in this one, you know, Catherine has been, she's not really, you know, when you don't have a lot of emotions, you're not really interested in taking lovers. And at one point, Regan asks her, like, well, you know, like, who do you like in the past? And Catherine tells her, I was always defenseless in the face of swineherds.
What? What?
And I was like, really? She, like, Catherine had an overwhelming attraction to swine herds. And I was like, it's so specific. Like, why a swine herd? Why not just like a, I don't even know what you call the other herders.
A shepherd?
A shepherd. I was like, I'm a city girl.
Also, like, there's something super gross about like hanging around all day with pigs.
I'm with you, but I thought
I
it was
no, Catherine.
It was, and I feel like it also.
I missed that on both readings. Now I wish you hadn't said it.
I literally was like, it's when they're in Antarctica. Maybe she was just like frozen with like crazy shit coming out of her mouth, like literally. But I was like, I was, and I kind of imagined her saying it in like a, you know, like a Streetcar Named Desire kind of voice. Like, I was always defenseless. In the face of swine herds, I could, like, okay, Catherine, you're doing better now.
Well, that, and we do discover that Led Zeppelin is fascinated by Valkyries in this book.
So I was like, oh, I'm going to do this research. They make this joke, right? Like, you know, Regan's listening to all these terrible songs. It's like Radar Love. And she's got this like Antarctica play mix, and they make this joke about a Led Zeppelin song called The Battle of Evermore, and I was like, I should look this up and listen to it. And I listened to it for about 10 seconds and was like,
nope.
So my conclusion, the only good Led Zeppelin song is Wish You Were Here, and all the rest of them, especially The Battle of Evermore.
Wait, is Wish You Were Here a Led Zeppelin song?
Oh, it's Pink Floyd.
Yeah, see, there it is. The best Led Zeppelin song is a Pink Floyd song.